The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon.
Hey, how
you doing? Joining another episode of We the People Radio. We're pre-recording, so everybody has to listen to pre-record this time. And I know you're going to want to call and ask questions, but you can't. You're just going to have to listen.
You'll have to chat amongst yourselves on the chat room.
You're going to have to hope that we ask all the questions that you are thinking. And if not, you can always email us. You can find information on the program at wethepeopleradio.us. Phone numbers, emails, all that stuff for us are on there. And we'd love to hear who you would like to hear from on future programs.
Yeah.
What are you rushing me?
No. No, I wasn't rushing. I didn't hear an introduction, though.
I was kidding there.
Oh, okay. All right.
So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
And we have Mark. We have Mark, our guest. We've shanghaied him into being our hostage on a Wednesday afternoon, actually. A balmy Wednesday afternoon. Because we want to talk about politics. Because we have a zillion questions. And of course, we can't answer them because we don't know anything. So we needed somebody else. We want to know how Iowa works and why Iowa is such a big deal.
And New Hampshire.
So, okay, before we do that,
yeah,
you've been working in politics for like a million years.
Not quite a million years.
We like to exaggerate here, so, you know, feel free to join in.
Yeah, about 16 years professionally in politics.
That's like
mostly
a million.
In California. As well as some national stuff in Nevada.
Did you start with campaign?
I started with campaigns. Started volunteering, walking precincts, making phone calls, the same thing everybody else does the first day they show up to campaign for somebody.
Interesting. And it seems like almost everybody who winds up working in, like actually for their job, working in the political field, starts out with campaign.
That's pretty true. I mean, you have two basic sides. Some people go to college, get a an internship in the Capitol, or get a fellowship, and they become and do legislative stuff, answer mail, that sort of stuff. And others gravitate to the more fisticuff politics, rough and tumble, out in the talking to folks and
putting up signs.
Is your experience primarily California?
Primarily California, but obviously got some national experience as well, both in Washington, D.C., and then working on presidential races. Worked for Romney in 08 and in 12. Worked on the Bush elect and reelect.
Oh, cool.
A little bit on the McCain race, but I was running a nationally competitive race for Congress that year.
Right.
So that kind of sucks all the air out of the room.
There's no other time but politics time when you're running a competitive. That was one of those that everybody spent millions of dollars in races.
So, okay, you know, there are people who run for city council, water boards, assembly, state senate. There's a ton of levels of races.
Everything
are they all kind of the same?
At the basic, they all start out the same, which is get your name out there, get name ID, and convey a simple message. Whether you're running for your local Republican or Democrat Central Committee, your water board, city council, and then when you get to Assembly, Senate,
sure.
Congress, U.S. Senate, you have to convey a much more complex message. But it's still about get your name out there. Get people to like you. Tell them what you're going to do.
And big, you worked on a gubernatorial race though for California, right?
Yep, I've worked for Tom McClintock when he ran in the recall. Also worked on Schwarzenegger's reelect. Worked with Meg Whitman when she ran.
So when there's that much territory, you know, just actual geography, you have a state that has this much room. Is it just a ton of people?
It's a ton of people. It becomes about how you organize them. Then, which is, and that some of that's the same whether it's locally, you want to get other people to help you. You want to ask them to come walk precincts, call, put up signs.
Because the bulk is volunteer, right?
Bulk is volunteer, and successful campaigns have lots of volunteers. Unsuccessful campaigns
The Blunkett staff.
Meg Whitman. Look at Jeb Bush right now. Jeb Bush has no volunteers in Nevada. He was paying everybody.
Oh, really?
If you weren't being paid by Jeb Bush, you weren't working on Jeb Bush's campaign in Nevada, which is another example of why Jeb Bush is
that's a big difference there, yeah.
Versus take Rand Paul, take Marco Rubio, take Ted Cruz, that are driven by many, many more volunteers. People are willing to put their time in to help elect them because they believe in the message. The only people that believe in Jeb's message are big donors in D.C. who are funding multi-hundred-million-dollar campaigns.
It begs the question, do you really believe in him or are you just doing it to get paid?
B.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder.
Okay, so because people say all the time that if it's all about money and the person who has the most money wins.
That's certainly not always true. You need enough money to compete and get your message out, but money doesn't solve the problem. If you have a horrible message, if you're a horrible candidate, you're never going to get elected. Meg Whitman had more money than anybody could ever think of and still lost to Uncle Jerry.
Mm-hmm. So these campaigns, when you look at the millions and millions they spend on campaigning, where's the bulk of that go? Is it media?
Bulk of it goes to media. Certainly consultants get a big chunk of it. But a lot of that is masked in consultant A is buying this media for you.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah.
Because there are companies. That's all they do. They're consultant companies that
they're
you don't
making
ever
a
really
percentage.
See them.
They're making a percentage of – they're getting anywhere between as low as 5% and as high as 15% agency commissions for placing the ads. They're producing the ads. They're making the sound behind them, the what actually gets said on them, and then placing the ads. You have placer buyers, essentially, and then you have media production companies. They're shooting the TV commercials.
The ones putting it all together and splicing everything and making it look pretty.
Make it look pretty and make sure that it is as the consultant or the candidate, depending on how involved each one is, decides it should be.
So it's representing the message and not leading people, the wrong direction.
Yes.
Was I thinking about that? Okay, so your campaign, the people who are campaign like engineers, they're kind of the behind the scenes.
Yeah, you generally have, even on these giant presidential, you've got different levels. You have your campaign manager, which is usually kind of your top guy. He's in charge on the day to day. A lot of this you can put in a football metaphor. The candidate is the quarterback and the owner of the team.
Okay.
Okay. Your campaign manager, consultant, however you put that, is kind of like the coach.
Okay.
All right.
But the candidate's still the guy on the field. And he's responsible, and he's the owner of the team. Then you have the rest of your supporting staff. You have the guy that's in charge of recruiting volunteers or gal or your media buyer, your radio guy, your the people that are actually walking precincts. Some of those are paid. Some of them are volunteers. Depending on how big and how local, how much that individual voter contact is. At the end of the day, this is about voter contact. If you walk someone's house, if you call them on the phone, a real life person calling them, it actually makes a difference, as annoying as they sound.
I was going to say, because people always say, oh, my gosh, they're calling again.
They always say they hate it. But at the same point in time, the reason they do that, every campaign that's successful does it, is because it makes you more likely to go to the polls and vote for that person. If it wasn't effective, people wouldn't stop doing it.
And I'm sure there's a number they shoot for. So many contacts will give you a 7%. Is it 7 contacts?
Really?
7.
Yeah.
7 is the minimum number of live body contacts to make the largest difference. Once you get past 7, you start getting diminishing returns. Anything under 7, you haven't reached your full potential.
So what about the robocalls?
Robocalls are because you don't have enough volume of volunteers to make it happen.
But they do them, so they must...
They do them. A lot of time, robocalls are especially done at the last part of the campaign because you can't. You're trying to respond to a message that maybe got put out by an opponent And that's the only way that you know you can deliver it to people mm-hmm. in that time frame.
Yeah, because it's a fluid deal. It's changing all the time.
Changing all the time.
And I imagine on a national campaign, the organization is a whole lot more complex because you have to set these operations up in every state. Or do they do it in every state?
Good ones do.
Yeah?
A good one will have an operation in every single county.
Wow.
In the entire
country. That would take some volunteers.
That takes a lot of volunteers.
Now, do they... Okay, so my question when we come back is, do they move them from state to state, or do they have them, like, in every state? And how do you find those people?
I mean, yeah, good question.
Let's write all that down.
Yeah, we can get back
You're responsible. It's your department. You remember. All right, we'll take a really quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Get fooled again. It's a kind of a good campaign song. All right. So we're talking about politics, all sorts of things. We thought we'd start with campaigns since that's kind of the beginning. And that's really mysterious for a lot of people, you know, the whole campaign thing. How does that work? The signs go up, you know. There's tons of rules about this, right?
Everything's based on a law.
Yeah. So if the signs are up before they're supposed to be up, or they don't have, there's a number that goes on all of them? There's a registration number or something?
It's completely different state by state, municipality by municipality, depending on what you're running for.
Really?
California has different rules. That's the same reason that every state has different rules for how they elect electors, to elect the president, to the nomination, to how we run elections, whether it's a caucus or a primary.
It's all by state?
Every state gets their own choices. That's federalism for you.
Well, they also have a rule on, and I learned this, I think, the last go-around, your signs have to come down after so many days after the election.
Again, that's all based on where you are. You know, here in California, most of the time, it's you can be up anywhere from 90 days to 60 days up. In some cases, only 30 days up, and they all have to be down within 4 days.
And then if they're
4 days?
4 days.
Oh, wow.
And then what if they're not?
This municipality or locality could fine you. Hmm. They could take them.
Hmm.
If you lost, it really isn't that big a deal because your committee's gone and there's no money left most of the time.
Your committee's gone, there's no money left. That was another thing I was thinking. Okay, so the cost. Somebody donates to a campaign. What percentage of...
really depends how good a fundraiser you are.
Yeah.
And how efficiently you run your campaign. This is why campaigns are a good microcosm for if you can manage a campaign, have low overhead, you might, in fact, be good at governing.
Right.
You can run a really complex, running for president especially, incredibly complex. You have people in all 50 states. You have, we were talking about before the break, do people move around? A little bit is kind of the answer. But somebody from New Hampshire doesn't know anything about California, how it works out here, or the people here.
Sure.
So sending them out here to run the ground operations, which is recruiting volunteers, getting them to do stuff, not really efficient.
Yeah, you're going to stink at it because you don't know the area.
He doesn't know the area. He doesn't know how long. He doesn't know that it takes 7.5 hours to drive from Sacramento to Alturas, or
or
where Alturas is.
Yeah.
Or if you're running from the Oregon border to the Mexican border, you really need a good 12 hours.
Right, right. Well, mm-hmm. It's funny you say that because I remember there was a story when Ben Carson got in the race. He had a tremendous war chest, but they were saying he went through his money quicker than anybody, and that's probably the reason.
Part of that is not knowing what you're doing, not having a good enough control of mm-hmm. it, and sometimes it's trusting the wrong people.
Right. Well, never having done it before, how would he know? You know, he'd have to get the right people on his staff to be able to put their finger on a lot of that stuff.
We look at essentially the reason why Scott Walker is not running today is because he burned through his money.
Mm-hmm.
Here was a guy that was at one point number one in the polls back in all through the spring into early July.
Sure.
Was raising a ton of money, but he was burning a ton of money. We call that in campaigns burn rate. If you can keep your burn rate down and save and husband your money for when it actually matters when you're talking to voters, then you've got a campaign and you can point to something. When these guys end up in millions of dollars of debt at the back end.
Yeah.
You know, that if you're running into millions of dollars of debt at the back end of your campaign, you probably weren't very good at it, and it might say something about your governing style.
What's that brings up another point. Let's say you raise $10 million for your campaign, and at the end of the campaign, win, lose, or draw, it's over, and you still have a couple million dollars left. What do they do with that money?
Well, depends, again, if you're a state or federal candidate, whatever. If you lost and you still got a couple million dollars, you can return it to your donors.
How do you know whose money you have?
You can give a percentage back or, you know, you have a lot of autonomy.
Does that ever happen?
I don't know of any time when that's happened.
There's
a few times when, you know, smaller campaigns, big campaigns,
sure.
You could save it to run for a different office.
So you can actually put in a fund, hang on to it.
As long as you're running, you can keep open a federal account virtually forever.
At the state level, I guess it would depend on the state.
Depends on the state.
But theoretically, if you ran for like the assembly, an assembly or house, I guess some states call it house,
mm-hmm.
seat, and you wanted to run for a state senate seat, you can roll that over, maybe?
Depends on the state. For the federal, let's say you were running for a U.S. House and then you lost and now you're going to run for a U.S. Senate or a different house seat. You can take all that money you had left over and throw it in because it's all federally compliant money.
Mm-hmm.
Throw it to the new race.
As long as it's spent on a campaign, it's...
As long as it's spent, the pretty much the three things you can do with it. You can give it back to the donor. You can use it for another race as long as it's – you can give it away or you can give it to a party or a charity. So you could give it to – if you're a Republican, give it to the Republican Party or you could give it to a charity. The one thing you can't do from it anymore – you used to be able to do this, and this was part of that corrupting in politics. You used to be able to take it home with you. At the end of the campaign.
Oh, wow. I think I'll run, but maybe not.
Look, I made a couple million bucks.
They got rid of those rules.
Yeah.
And so
probably wasn't so bad an idea.
That is not a bad idea. So they got rid of those rules. So you have to either give it to charity, give it to another political entity, or return it.
Can you donate it to another candidate?
Only within the limits. So if it's another federal candidate, you can only give them a maximum individual contribution.
Oh, okay. So it's a contribution at that point.
It's a contribution at that point. But you could give it to a 527 super PAC and then mm-hmm. spend it all on their behalf just
right.
independently. I'm doing the air quotes, independently.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so what's the rule that they all want to change? Mostly you hear the Democrats saying that they want to change all the campaign finance rules. What do they want to change? They want to get rid of the super PACs or something?
They want to overturn Citizens United, which is Citizens United was a decision by the Supreme Court basically says that money, it expands on another Supreme Court decision called Buckley v. Vallejo, where the city of Vallejo in California said, no, you can't give more than X amount of money in any way. Buckley v. Vallejo, and then the other one, Citizens United, basically says that money equals speech. That if you restrict the amount of money that I can spend,
then you have silenced
my ability to say it. That affects, and sometimes the Democrats are a little disingenuous on this because they want to exempt labor unions. or teachers' organizations.
Yeah. Gee,
or
that's handy.
People they never get a say in anything.
Well, they hardly ever vote for Democrats either.
Fund them. And we have to be honest about this. Super PACs are generally disproportionately Democrat.
Right. Super PACs are?
Oh, yeah. Billionaires tend to be Democrat.
So why do they want to get rid of that? Because they know that it's never going to happen and it sounds good?
Look, that requires a change in the U.S. Constitution.
Oh.
This was the United States Supreme Court decision.
I forgot about that.
You have to amend the Constitution to change that.
Okay, so you can squeal about it all day long.
You can talk about it all day long.
I'm the champion of the little guy.
We've tried to change it.
We've tried to change it.
We've done everything we can.
I'm doing everything I can to change it. But really, it's changing the U.S. Constitution. And I'm not going to get the states to agree to this. Or I'm not going to get, all the votes I need in the House and the Senate and the states to ratify it.
Right.
Interesting. Okay. Because, they always talk about that. I always wonder what they're talking about. I guess I figure everyone else.
Yeah. I'll give you my two cents, which is...
Some people probably are in the weeds about all this already, but for all us regular people.
Look, this is about spending money in elections.
Yeah.
And let's be honest about it. If you just went to reporting, right? Because this is hard. I mean, there's good people. Everybody knows great people who would make a great representative or a great senator, but they look at themselves and say, hey, look, I can't go around and spend my entire life raising money in $2,700 chunks.
Right.
There's just not enough time in the day. I want to run for United States Senate in California. It costs $50 million to be competitive.
And see, that's the rub there. Is you have to have millions to run for these offices. And people look at that and go, well, that's the corrupt system. Why should it cost millions of dollars?
The average open House seat, House of Representatives seat, the winner, on average, spent $1.1 million.
And that's the federal House?
Or federal House of Representatives.
$1.1
million. An incumbent spends on the neighborhood. An incumbent running for re-election in a relatively safe seat spends $500,000.
Right.
Because you still have to do all the same things. You need radio. You need television. I mean, they don't run those ads free.
They don't.
So you've got to pay for that. Mailers. We haven't talked about mailing. Mail is obviously effective because we all get it in our mailbox.
The hope is that you look at it.
You know, and the mailers, I've gotten mailers in my mailbox that were patently false. Are there rules about what they can say in mailers?
Well, if it's a candidate campaign or an independent expenditure. Independent expenditure, if they say something that's false,
they're... So the super PAC thing, right?
Super PAC, independent expenditures, they can be sued for libel.
Right.
Your opponent largely is shielded from libel. If you say something in a campaign environment, it's pretty much my First Amendment right as you as a candidate, as a public figure, goes back to Times v. Sullivan. It's almost impossible to sue them if they say something that's not true. That's where public pressure comes in. Where the public pressure is then used to get the person to apologize.
Right.
Because you can just demonstrably show to the public that he's lying or she's lying.
You can sue, but by the time that ever gets anywhere, the election's been over for 5 years.
if it's a candidate saying, if you and I are running against each other, it's almost impossible for you and I to sue each other and either one of us to win.
Right.
If you sued me, you'd probably be paying my lawyer's fees.
Okay, so you and Bill are running against each other, and I'm running a super PAC for Bill.
If you say something...
This is a super scary idea right now because we're getting our butt kicked, but... okay.
Aaron, if you say something against me that's not true, I can sue you. You're liable.
You can sue me because I'm super PAC.
Because you're a super PAC.
But Bill's not allowed... If I'm a super PAC, Bill is not allowed to tell me where to spend the money.
But Bill and you can't talk.
Because super PAC is separate.
Right. Super PAC legally has to be separate. All sorts of rules about that. If you two talk, you could be colluding. You could both possibly
that's
go to
where
jail.
You hear. That's what you hear on these ads. I'm so and so, and I
approve
this message.
If you're approving the message, it's a candidate ad. We're getting a little into the weeds on this.
That's okay though, because everybody's going to see all this all year. And I guess my thought is 2016 is going to be one of those races. It's a little bit like Obamacare. nobody really paid attention to how bills got passed. I mean, we learned about it in the eighth grade, I think, and then everyone forgot. But when the Obamacare bill was going through, people got really focused on, wait a second, how does this work? You know, it's got to go to the Senate. Well, it's got to go back to the House. I mean, what's a conference? How does that work? And I think this election is going to be one of those where it doesn't just fly by. Everybody's like, wait a second, how does that go again?
Which
so it's kind of like time for us to educate people in what is, you know.
Why Iowa, right?
Some of the weeds, huh?
Yeah, when we after our next break, I would like to talk about Iowa, talk about New Hampshire, and let's talk about a caucus versus a primary. What is the difference there?
Yeah, because there's a whole thing about that.
Mm-hmm. And why are these two so important?
And the folks in California that hear this program, it'll be the day before the Iowa caucus, and the folks in Philadelphia and New Jersey, they'll be listening on the day of. So this will be – we're getting this in just in time.
Yeah.
We were going to put it off a week,
yeah,
and it's like,
we couldn't put it off a week.
Ro-ro, we got to get it in now.
Yeah.
So anyway, take a really quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Go all the way back to the 60s to find campaign music.
Oh, there's great political
there's
music.
There's tons of
70s,
60s, tons of our music 70s, is 60s.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about a caucus.
Yeah, but before that, okay, don't forget mail, because everybody gets annoyed with the mail. And candidates send the mail because it works, but tons of that mail comes from PACs. And the PACs don't always, since they're not allowed to talk to the candidate, you ever see ones where the PACs send out stuff that it's like...
doesn't help?
Yeah, and the candidate's like, oh, God.
Yeah, you see that quite regularly in the super PAC, independent expenditure world, where they send something that's really... they thought they were helping, but it's just completely off message.
Yeah, and with the candidate not able to talk to them or intervene or any of that, I mean, they're kind of at their mercy.
So it happens more... that's one of those things that happens more at your state level or your local level.
Sure.
Where there's, you know, if it's in the presidential race and it, let's say it was something that hurt Ted Cruz or whatever, Ted would tell the media, well, I think that's completely unhelpful. And the message kind of filters back through the system.
But if you're running for the state assembly or the state senator or whatever, you don't have access to that kind of media.
So
everybody thinks you're a knucklehead.
Right. There's
that's
definitely...
brutal.
Definitely dangers of it, but in the world where you have such tight campaign limits, you know, it becomes one of those things that happens that people do because they think they're helping you, because they either agree with your philosophy or whatnot. But the money is so tight, it's so hard to raise, it takes so much time and effort, and it takes away from... you know, what you could be doing otherwise.
Well, you wind up having to spend money to counter it or explain it.
Yeah.
And, so I guess I was just thinking, you know, when we start getting all these things in the mail later this year, it'd be worth it to look and see where it came from. Did it come from the candidate or did it come from a PAC?
Every single one of them, they should have a return address that says who it's from. Mm-hmm. And it'll say the campaign committee. The other one is they have to have a disclosure on the bottom of every single one of who paid for it. If it's got a really long answer of who paid for it, it's probably a PAC. If it's a coalition of, you know, insurance agents, car dealers, association, teachers unions, and the environmental associations, it's a super PAC. They have
right.
any anything that has like a bunch of names is a super pack.
Because they send out those things that are, they look like, I'm assuming they do them in every state, but those things that come out that look like almost like a ballot. Here are all the candidates for all the different offices that we pick, and it's like car dealers or it's...
Well, those are called slates.
Yeah,
those are essentially, it's a for-profit business. Candidates buy onto those slates. It doesn't necessarily, most of them don't even necessarily have to anything to do with what the slate actually says. It could say cops, it could say firefighters, it could say anti-tax league or whatever. That's just somebody that's trademarked the name and is selling space on a piece of mail.
Get out!
And so you're buying how many impressions you get. And they'll buy it, sell it to one candidate or another. And they can, if you have two candidates interested, you get a bidding war.
Stop it.
No kidding.
So if it says it's by like the police or whatever, it's not necessarily...
It's not from your local police. Your local police, if you're in a city or county or whatever, they can't spend money on politics. Government is forbidden from spending money on politics.
Sure. And rightfully so.
Yeah, because they'd be spending taxpayer money on it.
They'd be spending taxpayer money. So if you see something that's got a shield or a star or whatever else, it's called a slate campaign, and it's something that's for sale.
Wow. Hmm. Huh. Well, that's good to know, because we all get those, and then you think, oh, well, that means this guy's better than the other guy. No, it just means he won the bidding war.
means you won, you know, and there's lots and lots of them. There's, like, Republican Women's Voice. There's Independent Voter Card. There's, unless it's from your official party, and then it'll say, this is from the Republican Party of California, of Pennsylvania, of New Jersey. Then that's from your official organization or your Democrat party. They have to identify themselves.
Interesting. Okay, so before we leave campaign, precinct walking. So people in the past, the only way they could really get involved was to maybe go to a local, their local headquarters for their Democratic headquarters or Republican headquarters or whatever, make phone calls. Maybe before the election, they might walk precincts that are organized out of there. But now they can make phone calls, what, off the computer?
Yeah, there's lots of different – technology changes everything.
Stuff they can do from home, really.
And in the Romney campaign, they rolled out where, especially if you had enough broadband, you could link your cell phone to your computer. They would spin up the list of people who call. All you do is hit the next button on your computer, and you just keep talking, and they keep connecting you to people.
Don't have to know anybody.
You don't
have to be connected in some way.
You're getting a list, and it's automatically connecting to your phone, and you have a script that you repeat, and it's, you know, hi, I'm Mark. I'm a volunteer with the Mitt Romney campaign. I'm calling to ask you to go to the caucus tomorrow and help pull for Mitt Romney.
And they have like a little script, I'm sure.
They have a little script right in front of them, and it just keeps going. Hi, is Marcy there? Marcy, I'm calling from the Mitt Romney campaign. I'm a volunteer, and you're an actual, honest volunteer. It's not somebody that's paid to do it. If they're paid, they have to tell you they're paid.
But I guess what I'm thinking is, you know, for all the people who feel like they're sort of out of the loop, especially those of us in California, because, you know, I mean, if you're a conservative in California, you're somewhat outgunned. But you could help elsewhere.
You can help
without
elsewhere.
Physically going there.
Without physically. Lots of campaigns have it. Everybody will have it for the fall campaign. Some campaigns are spending the money
for primaries. For the beginning, yeah.
I mean, if you're in California, I mean, look, the fight right now is in Nevada. Nevada's coming up in a few weeks. If you're in Philadelphia or New Jersey, I mean, New Hampshire's not that far. Or you can drive or you can call.
And so going from door to door, literally, because I remember the first time we did that and we went on that.
Makes a huge difference.
Down out of Sacramento. And the guy told us, remember, as we were walking out the door, we had our little packets, you know, and we were going to go knock on doors because it tells you exactly where to go and gives you literature to leave. And he said, now this is the third time you're going to these people's houses. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, they're going to kill us. And he said, no, you've got to do it. Like three taps on every door.
Yeah, seven individual human contacts is the goal.
Wow.
It makes you far more likely, especially when you're talking about people. You know, there's people who always vote. They're going to vote no matter what.
Sure.
And there's a bunch of people out there that don't vote that often. They get turned off by the process.
And those lists are made up of
voters.
The people that are most likely to vote. That's whose door you're knocking on.
At that stage of the game, especially when you're at the end of the campaign, That better be people who haven't already voted. You haven't already voted.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Who
remember that.
Will need to vote and are in your realm of possibility to get to vote. And that's where technology comes in. I mean, every campaign can get voter lists and everything, but what you do with the voter lists is what happens that you need some advice about. Mm-hmm. Because some people, you know, if you vote 1 in 10 elections and it's a primary election, you're probably not showing up. So
probably not worth deploying someone to your house.
But if you show up 50% of the time, and it's a general election for a president, you need to be at their house.
Interesting. Because and the way they lay them out is also because, remember the one, we walked down there in Sacramento and we had to keep crossing the street. We felt like you were doing like a round and around and around and around.
Campaign should always have things separated, even and odd, so you have two people walking, one on one side of the street, one on the other.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You know, you can tell a lot about a campaign that way, too. Now, okay, as far as raising money for the campaign, I remember you had told me one time 30% was about average to pay for the cost of raising money.
Yeah, 30%.
Sounds kind of crazy, but...
30% overhead is... Yeah, you know, that's a baseline for at least fairly efficient. I mean, there's plenty of people who can do it less than that. But you've seen some people. There's a well-known conservative former congressman from the South who spent 90% of his money raising money. He raised a ton of money, but he had no money to actually run his campaign when it came
because
time.
Because 90% of it went back into raising the money and only 10%
was available.
He raised
$5 million
do...
for his congressional race, but 90% of it was spent raising money.
Right.
And not enough. And he had a great, you know, he's still a guy that you see all over Facebook, has his own little super PAC now and everything, but he spent a ton of money raising the money. And at that case, you'd probably be better off raising less money and having more to actually run your campaign.
Yeah.
He ended up losing.
Brutal. Well, you can tell all this by looking up on the Secretary of State website.
Yeah, if it's federal, the FEC.gov tells you all the stuff about the how much and what you're spending. There's other, you know, websites. Open Secrets is out there and other ones that can tell you what your candidates are spending on and where they're getting money from.
Nice. Well, I think... I think that's some of that stuff is always kind of a mystery for people. You know, where does the money go? And so if you contribute to a candidate, is it worth doing or are they just going to blow it? You know, that's another thing. You know, a lot of people are pretty, you know, it's like, well, I might spend my time, but maybe I'm not going to contribute.
Well,
how do they know?
How do they know? Well, they can look obviously online and see what they are spending their money on. You know, if you're spending $30,000 a month on consultants, don't give them money.
they're like kids.
and they have to post that information?
They have to post all that. You know, Meg Whitman was a great one. She had tons of money. And she was just paying outrageous salaries to people because that's what they could demand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she...
So just because you know, are smart in the business world doesn't necessarily mean you're going to... Campaign is really its own animal.
It's its own animal, and having people you can trust, you know, is a big deal.
That is a big deal. We'll post those sites. You know, you can give me some of those to post that people can go look at and do research.
Whatever your Secretary of State is for your state, and each state's different.
Sure.
But for California and federally, everything gets posted online. Every report, you know, there's a minimum dollar threshold, so anything over... $100 for California, $200 federally. It's all online. Who gave it?
So you can see exactly who gave it
and exactly what it's being spent on.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Cool.
All right. This is a big topic.
It is a big topic.
There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, we got questions.
I know. It's a good thing people can't call in. We have more questions.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I kind of like to be the president.
Oh, yeah.
it is going to be like war this year. It's only right we should play their songs. So we're here with Mark Spanigal. We're talking about campaigns. So, all right, so we shifted. Let's talk about Iowa and all that. How does that, I mean, I think people at home that don't live in Iowa are like, what the heck? So tired of hearing about Iowa. Why are they the boss of everything?
Look, Iowa's first.
Why is Iowa the boss of us?
Iowa's first out of a quirk, okay? After 1968 and the meltdown, it used to be, prior to 1968, party bosses, essentially, your state party chairman, in association with the bigwigs, called the primary or caucus whenever they wanted. They gave you 30 days notice and said, hey, we're having one.
Really?
Go.
No fooling.
Which is how you had the giant mess of the Democrat meltdown of 68 at their convention.
I don't know anything about it. I was 7. You weren't even born. What do you know about the Democrat meltdown of 68?
Come on, you got to study some history here.
Okay,
but,
I'm bad.
You know, it
I
went
don't
to
know.
The floor, giant meltdown, riots in Chicago.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Bill's old.
Well, everything was thrown into disarray with Bobby Kennedy's assassination, if I remember correctly.
This is the convention showdown.
Right. But he was leading in delegates at the time, I believe.
You're probably right on that. I just remember the convention showdown, which is what led to this. The convention showdown basically said we have to have party rules. You have to give notice. So here's how Iowa became first. Just so happened that this is when Jimmy Carter is running.
Okay.
So we're in 72. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Iowa, because they have such a long, drawn-out process, and they had to publish the dates, and they couldn't get the hotel for the date they wanted in Des Moines to hold their state caucus convention. So they had to push it back later and earlier in the primary season. So because the way their caucus works is you go the first day, you have a everybody stand, for Democrats, they stand in different corners of the room. And if you don't get 10%, then you have to redistribute. Or you can vote for nobody, and you're undeclared.
They literally vote by where they stand?
Yes. For the Republicans, there's a ballot.
Okay.
We'll get to that in a second. But because it takes so many steps, if you have a precinct,
yeah,
then a county, then a congressional district, then a state district, then there's a giant gap between each one. It pushed them to the very beginning. Jimmy Carter, recognizing this, realized that they would have outsized influence because they were the first one. This is the first time there was a set calendar for when the primaries were taking place. And in this case, a primary caucus. So he spent a lot of time and effort there.
Now, what's the difference between a caucus and a primary?
So a primary is an election. You go to the polls, you cast a ballot.
Mm-hmm.
A caucus means everybody gets together. So all the Republicans get together in one room, and all the Democrats get together in a room.
Or how big of a like in
by
their county, town?
By counties, yeah. or by
no, they're precincts, which is a portion of the county.
Okay.
So they start small in precincts, and then they make a selection at that precinct, and then take that selection to the county.
And then a certain number of people go represent their precinct?
Represent their precinct.
Eh.
And then they all get together because the precincts are all supposed to be about the same size. And then to carry proportionality through the system, mm-hmm, they send people to the next level, which is a county caucus, and they decide who the county supports. Then they go forward and go to a congressional district caucus. And then from that congressional district caucus, you go to the state party.
And at each one of those, they're voting for their candidate?
Yeah, but they're bound all the way through, unless
okay,
their candidate. So this guy for Republican. Republicans and Democrats have different rules. The parties set the rules for these things. Parties aren't amongst themselves, their own organization. They're a private organization. They set their own rules. So under Republican rule, the guy you stand for or vote for the first day, you have to stand for the whole time. If you don't, you're kicked out automatically and replaced.
No switching teams.
Ah. Okay. But Democrats, that's not necessarily, depending on the state, a requirement. You can switch teams in midstream. If your guy gets less, or gal, gets less than 20% you can switch teams.
You can drop them and move on. Tell me this. Okay, so how long does that take? Is it like night after night after night, or is it like once a week for a month? Or
Iowa will wrap up after California in June.
Oh, wow. So the thing next Monday
is the beginning of the process, but where it has outside influences, it's the beginning of the process.
Yeah.
There'll be a vote from the caucuses that'll be public.
At the precinct level.
At the precinct of who won how many precincts.
Okay, so that pretty much tells you who the winner was.
The winner is based on who won how many precincts.
Right.
Then you have followed up New Hampshire. Now, essentially, the state legislatures of both New Hampshire and Iowa have since passed laws saying, hey, this is great, people pay attention to us, that say we have to be first. But parties can penalize you. In 2012, Florida, trying to become...
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, I remember that, too.
Trying to change the date.
They changed the date. They came really early. They were still after everybody else, but they were before they were allowed to by the parties. So they lost half of their delegates at the national conventions. So the parties have the power to change that. If the parties said, well, Iowa, you can still be first, but we're not seating any of your delegates. If you want to be seated, you have to come in after this date.
Mm.
Parties can set that. They just haven't been willing to, at this point, change up who gets to do it. Nevada has a slightly different system. See, in Iowa, somebody actually gets up in front of the whole crowd and makes a pitch on behalf of everybody's candidate, whether it be the presidential candidate themselves or a surrogate. There's somebody in front of every room that's making a pitch. For the Democrats, they literally stand up and move to different parts of the room to show support for who they want.
I know, doesn't it sound crazy?
For Republicans, they cast a ballot, and the winner wins in that precinct.
And so this process is how they vote for president, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
How they vote for state senate, federal senators?
You know, I haven't paid a lot of attention to Iowa's down-ticket races.
I'm just kind of curious because I'm like, do they do it all at the same time?
Let me throw this to Utah.
Okay.
Utah got rid of their primary and went to a caucus, and they nominate at the caucus.
Okay.
Okay, so you win your congressional caucus. You're the Republican nominee. That doesn't prevent somebody else from running, but it prevents somebody else from running with the party's support.
Okay.
Now how does that tie in the Electoral College? Totally different?
Totally separate. One is how you become the nominee from the party,
right,
and one is how you win the presidency. So I'll speak for Republicans here, because Republicans and Democrats have a slightly different way of doing it. There's just shy of 2,500 possible delegates to the RNC, 2,443. And so you need 50% plus one to be the Republican nominee. So each state, like California, we apportion ours by congressional district. So if District 1 votes one way, they get three delegates. Those three delegates are the delegates. They go for whoever won. They're bound to vote until that person drops out for that person.
So each district then will go with their delegates.
Yep. So each can – this is that behind-the-scenes thing.
Yeah.
So – right here, kind of when they're doing the filing, when they're starting, each campaign has to submit their electors and delegates. They have to name the three people from each and every district who are going to be their people that are willing to go.
Okay.
Very interesting.
All right, let's pick this up.
Okay, we're doing some more Iowa, and we'll get into all the rest of it when we come back. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
Beautiful. More beautiful. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
¶¶
Welcome back to Hour 2 of We the People Radio. You're here with Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
Okay, Mark, you were on the first half. Now you have to say who you are.
My name is Mark Spanigal. Work in Republican politics.
We're talking about all the stuff that is the big, deep secret of... It shouldn't be a secret, but I guess it is. Did we learn this in school?
Yes, you learn this in school.
God, I don't remember learning any of this in school.
Well, you don't learn about party politics in school, because that's something that is really the behind the scenes
of
how does the nomination actually happen. It's definitely the weeds, because, you know, who knows that there's 2,443 possible delegates to become the Republican nominee.
Yeah,
you don't need to know that. You just need to know, he won out Iowa and New Hampshire.
But
he's got the momentum.
We get, like, bludgeoned by this stuff all day, every day, and I think it's kind of fun to know how it's going behind the scenes. So let's see. You can catch us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We'll put up as much information. Right now I have two websites to add to this show. I really need to come up with some more information. This is just a ton of stuff that we don't typically talk about.
Well, I think people learned about this in school, but as time goes on, you don't stay on top of it. You forget a lot of it, and now I think more and more people are becoming involved in politics and need a little refresher course.
Well, that's why I thought this was important for 2016, because I think people are paying attention like they never have. And in order to become involved, you have to know how it works. You have to know how to do that. So if you didn't listen to the first half, you should go back and do that, because that was kind of all about the campaign side of things. Now we're into the actual voting side of things. So how does the nominee become the nominee? And I don't know, all that good stuff. So, all right. Back to where we were. We were talking about Iowa. So Iowa became first after 1968.
After 68. 72 was the first year it became first, and that was because for the first time, we had set rules that you had to publish. Mm-hmm. And because Iowa has such a long, complicated process, because you have local, county, congressional, and state different conventions that you have to go through. Those all take time, and there's 30 days between each one. They had to be first to make it in the calendar.
In order to fit, so they could be done in time. So when we talk about the parties set the rules, so I guess is this why, like, third parties never really get anywhere, because they just don't have the machinery?
They don't have the bandwidth. The people signed up with them to do it. Essentially, it takes, if you're a third party, if you're others, you need signatures. You need to qualify. Then the other national parties, the Republicans and Democrats, don't necessarily require it, because they have all that machinery and the people and the registration.
Yeah, everything's already in place.
It's already in place. They kind of automatically qualify.
Okay.
If you're running for Bob's Big Boy Party nomination,
you don't have enough guys.
You got to get enough guys. You got to have signatures, and it takes a lot of signatures. That's why right now, you know, there's the news story about Michael Bloomberg talking about he's thinking about running as an independent for president to challenge Hillary and whoever the Republican nominee is. In order for him to do that, like Ross Perot, he has to get on the ballot in every state. Yeah, he doesn't have to get nominated, but he has to get enough signatures in every single state to get put on the ballot. And some states make it really hard for non-party, non-Republican or Democrat or Libertarian, Green Party.
And how many signatures do they need?
Probably depends on
just
the state.
Just depends on the state?
Depends on the state. Some are percentage of – California is usually a percentage of how many people participated in the last election. Mm. So, like, an initiative here in California, you need 400,000 signatures, valid signatures, to get on the ballot. I believe for California, it's similar to that to run as an independent.
Dang. Mm. So if you don't have a lot of people helping you,
or a lot of money,
or a ton of money, you're kind of hosed. Okay, so we talk about how the party makes all these rules and stuff. So start from the kind of, like, bottom up. How do you get to be the chairman of a party? Like, what's the food chain look like?
Food chain. All parties start as local. You have a local county or local regional, what we in California call a central committee. You're an elected body in California. Other places, not so much. You could caucus, you could join, whatever. If you want to be a member of your local Republican Central Committee, you go down to the elections office and say, hey, I want to be on the Republican Party. They can, when it's time to file, they give you the form, you file, You run like everything. A lot of times, not enough people runs. It never makes it to the ballot. You're automatically it. And then they fill the committee. And that committee, made up of local people in your local county, then elect a chairman. And they elect delegates to the state party convention.
And does each, if there's one per, does it matter what state you're in if there's one per county?
No, there's one per county.
Okay. So you have one committee per county, and they all send the same number of people to their state convention?
Nope, based on population.
Okay.
Usually. Every state gets to decide their own.
Okay.
Most states, it's based on population. More populous areas with more of that party registrant gets more representation.
Oh, and that makes sense. I mean, some of these counties, you got, you know,
they have, 7,000 people in Mota County or something? Yeah.
Yeah. And more, you know, some state parties give bonus delegates to people who are more active. Let's say your county party has a headquarters, makes 10,000 phone calls. Everybody that's elected there is a Republican. They might give you more delegates because you're active and you're doing things.
Oh, interesting.
Versus a county that has a bunch of Republicans but doesn't have any elections, it never makes it to the ballot, you're automatically it. And then they fill the committee. And that committee, made up of local people in your local county, then elect a chairman. And they elect delegates to the state party convention.
And does each, if there's one per, does it matter what state you're in if there's one per county?
No, there's one per county.
Okay. So you have one committee per county, and they all send the same number of people to their state convention?
Nope, based on population.
Okay.
Usually. Every state gets to decide their own.
Okay.
Most states, it's based on population. More populous areas with more of that party registrant gets more representation.
Oh, and that makes sense. I mean, some of these counties, you got, you know,
they have, 7,000 people in Mota County or something? Yeah.
Yeah. And more, you know, some state parties give bonus delegates to people who are more active. Let's say your county party has a headquarters, makes 10,000 phone calls. Everybody that's elected there is a Republican. They might give you more delegates because you're active and you're doing things.
Oh, interesting.
Versus a county that has a bunch of Republicans but doesn't have any elected Republicans to anything. You might get penalized because you're not producing anything.
Right.
Then those people go to the state convention and they elect a state party chairman. Now, there's a state party chairman, a national committee woman, and a national committee man from each state, and that's what makes up the RNC, the Republican National Committee, who sets the rules.
Is the chairman?
It's a chairman,
mm-hmm.
a national committee man, and a national committee woman. Those three people from every state and territory set the rules for the party, pick the national chairman, Rens Primus, who's elected from them. And they also become automatic delegates to the national convention. They get a vote regardless. They don't have to commit to anybody. They're the Republican version of superdelegates. Democrats have these things called superdelegates for when they're running. You probably heard a lot about them. Hillary spends a lot of time courting superdelegates. Those, for Democrats, that's a much bigger pool. That's about a third of their delegate selection, and that's mega donors. Those are the Tom Steyers of the world that fund, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for Democrat causes and campaigns. Those are people like Nancy Pelosi. You know, Paul Ryan isn't in amongst himself a delegate to the Republican National Convention, even though he's the Speaker of the party. He doesn't get an automatic appointment. He could get his appointment from his state, and he probably will. But he doesn't get an outsized influence the way Nancy Pelosi does, or Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein. Those are super delegates because they're important to the party structure.
Interesting. And so the parties determine literally how those go. Okay, so once, do they meet? Does this national committee meet?
National committee meets, you know, pretty regularly. They have phone calls and that sort of stuff, and then they meet in person, I think, 4 times a year.
And they decide.
They decide policy. They decide when. Those are the folks that decide who gets to moderate debates.
Ah.
Who gets when primaries can be so your delegates are actually seated. They don't decide for the state, but they decide, well, if you pick a date before this date, before January 21, then you don't get any delegates seated. They set those other rules, and that's why, you know, the party kind of stepped in 2016 from 2012, where everything kind of crowded to the beginning. Now we moved everything back a little bit. We're no longer voting, you know, the second week in January in Iowa.
Right. Okay.
Now, can they change those rules during the process, or is once they set them at the beginning, they run with them?
For fairness, they pretty much set the rules once, and that's it.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So is it pretty representative of the country, or, I mean, have we gone through times when this whole idea got kind of seriously corrupted and had to get flushed and reset? I mean, has it always been like this from the beginning of the country?
Well, didn't have parties in the beginning.
I mean, not at the very, you know. But
it's been like this since the rise of party politics. I mean, you can look back in history and guys, you know, Boss Tweed from New York, you know, the machine politics. It's been like this for quite a long time. And I'd say it's definitely softer than it has been in the past. I mean, look at some of the stuff with Teddy Roosevelt and Judd Hanna and, you know, back in the day, you know, early 1900s about party machinery moving and blocking and trying to stop some people and promoting. It's a much lighter touch today than it ever has been.
So now they decide when...
how delegates are seated.
Okay.
And then, so you get a delegate. The delegates get the nomination, help secure the nomination. That's, you know, nationwide. Every congressional district gets three delegates, no matter where you are. Those delegates then select the nominee. Then you get the official nominee. Then you go to the Electoral College, which is, again, another representative. It's not a direct election. The winner doesn't actually win until the Electoral College shows up and votes.
Okay, we're gonna talk about that.
Okay, yeah, we got to figure that out because back to the eighth grade again when we were goofing off. I'm glad I wasn't the only one goofing off in eighth grade. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Give a damn's busted.
Well, I called the congressman and he said, quote, I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, cause there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
I didn't remember that part of that song. Good one, Bob. All right. Back here at We the People. With Mark, our hostage, who's explaining everything that we apparently did learn in school, but don't remember.
But forgot.
Oh, my gosh.
So we got through the delegate process, or the delegate process.
Delegate process. So every congressional district gets three delegates. So then those guys go...
to the national convention. You see, you know, on TV, little bit anymore that you see on TV. This year, they're going to be in July rather than in August, September. They moved them forward this year. So there's because of money. Because before, if you ran them late, you can only spend general election money in that period after you get the nomination.
Because you have different money. There's general election money and primary money.
Oh. And by moving them forward, you can raise more general election money, and you have a longer period to spend it.
Interesting. So what happens if you have primary money left?
You can spend primary money in general election, but it doubles. So if you have $2,700 you can raise for the primary, you also have $2,700 you can raise for the general. It's all for the eventual election in November. But let's say you raise $5,400 the first time. You can only spend $2,700 of it. And trust me, the FEC wants to make sure you have that other $2,700. If you spend that, you might find yourself in some trouble.
So that means that they're working with a diminishing resource if they don't move that up. Okay, that makes sense. All right, so you send those guys back to the convention.
Big convention, happy 4 or 5 day party. They nominate their guy or gal, and most of the time you already know what's happening ahead of time because of what's happened in the primaries. This year, maybe we know, maybe we don't. You know, who knows, maybe Hillary gets indicted after she's already won and decides she has to drop out.
You know, dare to dream.
We can all dare to dream these things. hey, let's say it's within the realm of possibility. But why would they indict her before she's already won, right? If she's already won, then you can get Joe Biden. If she's already out, then you're stuck with Bernie Sanders.
Ruh-roh.
If she gets indicted in 3 weeks from now, you're pretty well stuck with Bernie Sanders, because guess what? Joe Biden hasn't qualified for an election anywhere. He collected no signatures to get on the ballot. Those were things that you had to start last year on.
So they can't change the rules?
Well, they changed them every time somebody dies or whatever. I mean, you can go to a judge and get a judge to let you get on the ballot. But it's harder.
It's awkward and messy.
Stimulating circumstances.
Awkward and messy. But, you know, it's one thing where they let them on the ballot because somebody withdraws or they die or whatever. This is somebody getting indicted. It's not like they...
But they got to get on a ballot in every state.
They got to get on the ballot in every state.
Right.
That's a heavy lift.
That is a heavy lift. Whereas Hillary has the nomination already sewed up and she gets indicted later, she can withdraw. Then all of her delegates are still the delegates, but they're now free agents.
And then can somebody...
Then they can vote for whoever they want.
And they can put Joe Biden up there and he doesn't have to...
Didn't have the baggage of running through a primary.
Interesting. Right. Okay.
So that's why there's been no decision yet.
That's why there's no panic to do that at this point. Okay.
Just a theory.
Yeah. Just saying.
We're just talking about it. Yeah. So, all right, they all go to the convention now. The three from each congressional district are casting their...
They have to vote for who their
congressional district voted for.
And according to... states can set different rules. Sometimes if your preferred candidate falls below a threshold, officially you can become a free agent by the state rules. RNC basically says if you don't vote for who you came to vote for, you're null and void, you're kicked out and replaced.
Oh. Now, do the Democrats get three from each congressional district, too? Is it the same number of people on both sides, or their party decides that?
Their party decides that. I don't work in Democrat politics, so that's one of those things I follow a little less than Republican politics.
I was just curious if it was like a rule they had to be the same.
They have the superdelegates, and then they have delegates from – they have a much more complicated process.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There's coalitions. You need the Women's Coalition, the LGBT coalition. You need the various different groups.
But Republicans don't have that.
No.
It's just
show up and vote.
Figure so.
Okay, so we get to the convention. We elect a nominee.
A nominee.
Okay, so now we have a Republican nominee. We have a Democratic nominee.
Green Party, Libertarian, all same stuff, same basic principle.
Okay.
So now
what happens between that and the general? Just everybody getting the message out, trying to get everybody retooled.
Then you start the fight. That's where Electoral College comes in, because you need 270 Electoral College votes. And different states get different votes. California gets 55, the most of anybody.
Based on population.
Okay.
But the Electoral College is basically set up as a way of protecting small states. Because if you only cared about popular vote, you would only campaign in big cities. Why would you ever show up?
Sure.
Why show up to Ohio? There's no particularly populous big city. I mean, yeah, you got Cleveland, but it's not that big a deal. It's not that many votes compared to New York, Florida, Los Angeles, San Francisco Bay Area, even Sacramento. I mean, Sacramento is the 18th largest city in the country. So... you spend all your time in the urban centers, trying to get all the votes you could. And then whoever wins the most votes, and now what happens if we're fighting over like 100 votes?
Well, how does that
you throw the entire country into
how does that champs? Protect the small states? I mean, if California gets 55 votes and Ohio gets 20, wouldn't they spend most of
Pennsylvania gets 20 because only some of them are in play. You know, California, given what California is, it's going to go hard D anyway.
Right.
So you get what's called swing states, and you'll hear about this
ad
nauseum. You know, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Colorado, New Mexico.
So that's where they're going to go.
That's where they're going to go, because those are states, you know, maybe throw Wisconsin in the mix this year.
Because they could go, they could go Democrat. Okay.
And you need to get 270 votes. And based on what's solidly Republican and what's solidly Democrat, you have to campaign in those states to win 270.
Now, with this election, they're saying that a lot of, maybe not a lot, but a fair amount of Democrats are going to vote for Trump. Would that make it worth their while to come to states like California and campaign for those votes?
You're still going to spend most of your time in quote-unquote swing states. There'll be what will happen is more states go into that swing state category, and some states that used to be swing states will swing out and swing to safe columns. You always, part of this is you're narrowing the field of battle.
Sure, because it's really hard to campaign in 50 states.
It's really hard, and it's really expensive.
Right.
You know, you're still going to come to California because you want the money, right? You're going to raise money in California because California is an ATM state. You're still going to go to New York. You're still going to go to, you know, you're going to go to Florida because not only are there a lot of people, but there's also a lot of votes. But you're going to make a trip probably to just about every state anyway, just as a presence or whatnot. But the big part will be spent the most money. That's where you see the incredible amounts of campaign dollars, the commercials that run every day, all day, nonstop.
So it's 50% plus one?
50%
plus one. For the electoral vote.
For the electoral college. You need 50% plus one, which is 270.
Okay.
And so a lot of people say, well, we should get rid of the electoral college.
Getting rid of the electoral college throws you into a big danger. Okay, everybody remembers Florida, or think back to Florida, 2000.
Talking about the hanging chad.
Hanging chad. That was one state going through craziness. Now, amplify it for 50 states, because you are now, let's say you're under the 1% threshold. There's less than 1%. And, you know, look, elections can be close. I've been on some statewide races where the difference between the winning candidate and the losing candidate was half a vote per precinct. Basically, if one person showed up in every other precinct, the Republican would have won. The constitutional conservative would have won versus a flaming lefty billionaire.
Yeah, so you're talking like 100 votes for the whole state.
For the state of California, it ended up being 13,000 votes. But don't tell me your vote doesn't count.
Yeah.
The vote counts, and that's why you have to show up. Some of it's, you know, maybe you hate the governor's candidate. Maybe you don't like your state assemblyman. Show up and vote for the rest of the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay? Because it makes a huge difference. I mean, look, state of California, we got a gal now that's our attorney general running for U.S. Senate out here, Kamala Harris, gun grabber extraordinaire. She barely won. And I mean barely. We're talking like one vote a precinct. And she's not there.
Mm-hmm.
She was losing on election night and came back in the end on the late count, which is basically all the votes that they hadn't got counted by the end of election night, all the late absentees and all that stuff. It's a mess. But if you don't show up, you don't get to make the rules.
Right, right.
So the Electoral College, do they go there? Do they do this electronically? Do they do this?
They physically show up in D.C. So every candidate, the Republican, the Democrat, Libertarian, Green Party, they select one elector, right? So you get an elector for essentially it's every member of Congress the state has plus every U.S. senator. So however many seats you have in the U.S. House plus two. So the minimum number is three. You know, Wyoming gets three. Alaska, three. Even small states get three. Then everybody else gets more depending on how their population, how many seats they get. So they actually named someone. So in that case, Mitt Romney, actually, he had a elector named for every single of the possible electors in every single state. And so did Barack Obama. And if you win that state, now some states apportion differently. This is one of those, you know, one of the things for California we talk about, how would you make California relevant in a presidential race? You make California relevant by doing what Republicans do in their primary and apportion by congressional district, which means if you won 15 congressional districts, you won 15 electoral votes. That's certainly a reason to show up in California.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of winner take all. Winner take all, right.
So there's a couple states that have by...
Who decides if it's winner take all or if it's apportion?
State does. State election law. So your state legislature or through the initiative process.
What's the split on that?
So we're screwed.
I mean, how many are...
I think there's four states. That's just shooting off the hip. I believe it was four states that apportion versus
I think it's just Nebraska and Maine that do that, that apportion the Electoral College by percentage as opposed to winner take all.
Interesting.
All right, we're going to
come back.
That's
too bad we don't do more of that. That would actually, yeah, that would make everybody more relevant. Huh. All right. More to come. Stick with us. We have a little break here. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online. Oh, don't join us online. We have to talk about some other stuff. Oh, okay. You can join us online now. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Somebody's gonna hurt someone before the night is through. Somebody's gonna come undone. There's nothing we can do. Everybody wants to touch somebody. If it takes all night, everybody wants to take a little chance. Make it come out.
Then go to the White House door. That's what he says he'll do. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue.
Yeah, I want to know who that is.
That's Merle Haggard.
Wow. A local song for us, Rainbow Stew. That's scary. Okay. So the Electoral College
is a winner-take-all in most states.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what if? So we were talking about during the break, which always happens. We always talk about all the good stuff while no one can hear us. If in fact the states all decided for some reason somehow to go to an apportioned type of a process, that would be really good for Republicans.
Well, it would, because let's face it, we have 243 Republicans to Congress. And then we have the most governors we've ever had.
31-ish, 2-ish?
We have quite a few. We have more than we had when Barack Obama mm-hmm. was elected.
He's been very good for the conservative movement, hasn't he?
He has certainly energized the conservative movement. It would, especially if you apportion Electoral College based on congressional districts, then Republicans would pretty much own it for the decade.
Hmm. Interesting. And so when was the last time that changed anywhere? Like a million years ago?
Districts? Districts change every 10 years.
No, I mean the whether you're apportioned or whether you're winner take all. Like when was the last time that actually switched around?
It's been a long time. So been a very long time. That's again a state decision on when they get to what they get to choose. If any state want to change it, it's either their legislature could do it,
okay,
or the people could do it by a referendum or initiative. But that would be certainly shake up the way we select president, because then it means that in those swing districts in the country, the president's going to show up, whoever it is.
Everybody's a swing district at that point.
You have hard R districts, and there's not a lot of point in the president showing up to Nancy Pelosi's district.
Right.
They're going to vote for a Democrat, whatever it is.
But they don't show up to California because they already know that all, it's.
They get all 55 is going outside the ATM, California, basically collect money. They don't show up to California. This year might be different. It depends how crazy the Republican nomination or Democrat nomination is. There's an outside possibility with this many candidates that have this much money, if they can all hang on long enough, it might not be decided by June when it gets here. We get to that weird place where you get a brokered convention.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Essentially, a brokered convention gets to be where, and I know it sounds, when you say brokered, it sounds, but that's where the delegates decide. Okay? You get in the room, and they start voting. And then they, once you drop out the people that didn't meet minimum thresholds, if you don't get 10%, you drop off the ballot.
Oh, okay.
Okay? So they keep voting. And keep voting
until they get the right number?
Until you drop off the ballot till you can get 50% plus one. This is how Abraham Lincoln became our first Republican nominee. He was everybody's second choice. Nobody came to convention with enough votes to be the nominee.
Hmm. But yeah. They know pretty much ahead of time how they're going to vote, though, don't they?
Well, they're required to because they're submitted.
Right.
But let's say nobody gets enough on the natural through the election.
Mm-hmm.
To go into the convention with 50% plus one. This is for the nomination, not the Electoral College.
Right.
Okay. But if nobody has enough, because if the Electoral College can't select, it goes to the House of Representatives, by the way.
Yeah. I heard about that the other day. Okay, so how does that go?
If the Electoral College, if they can't determine a winner, if there's nobody gets 270 votes,
yeah,
it goes to the House of Representatives, and a majority vote wins.
Hmm.
Wow.
Well, we know how that would turn out.
That could be a snazzy game changer. Well, when was the last time that happened?
You're testing my level of history that I don't know.
I think it was in the 1800s.
Yeah, I was going to say it has happened, though, right? I heard this the other day, and I just didn't commit it
to
memory.
Well, but part of this goes back to, you know, when John Adams was elected, he was elected by the House. Okay? Previously, we didn't. You didn't have a national election. You know, in the early days of the Republic, the House selected the president.
Mm-hmm.
It was an indirect election. We changed that, and we made the Electoral College as a compromise so that small states still mattered.
Mm-hmm. Because if we didn't have the Electoral College, we're
then
no longer a republic.
Then you would only spend time in the... Then you're a direct democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When was the last time we had a brokered convention?
Well, 68 was a brokered convention for the Democrats.
Right.
Can't tell you the Republican one.
Is it considered a bad thing? I mean,
it creates intrigue.
Yeah.
Because
nobody knows
who's going to be the nominee, and that's where you can get wild card nominees.
Yeah,
Some guy that could never run. You could end up with Paul Ryan being the next Republican.
Yeah.
Because nobody, then you could nominate anybody from the floor.
Oh, okay.
And all
I did
it
not
takes is a majority of people. Voting for you.
So that's where there's a lot of politicking going on down on the floor to get those votes.
Okay, so that's how
on the floor, in the hotel room, with the cigars and the scotch.
Yeah. Exactly.
Does it come with a basement?
And a beating.
Exactly. All right, everybody out to the alley. Interesting. So it looks like a jury room.
12 angry men.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting. So what do you think will happen?
Most likely, the same thing that normally happens. By then, we'll have
It'll figure itself out.
You know, here's what normally happens. Candidate loses. Somebody that has high expectations loses a few races, and they stop being able to raise money. Their burn rate is too high. They have to get out because they can't afford to compete anymore.
And they roll their support towards...
The eventual winner. So,
right. And that pretty much seals the deal.
That pretty much seals the deal.
What'd you find?
Just a point of interest. Wikipedia says Adlai Stevenson of the 1952 Democrat Party and Thomas Dewey of the 1948 Republican Party were the most recent brokered convention presidential nominees of their respective parties.
Hmm.
They're not respected, of
course. Gotta love Wikipedia and Bob. Thanks, Bob.
The last winning presidential nominee produced by a brokered convention was FDR in 1932.
There you go.
So this truly is, in the weeds for everybody. Nobody knows how this works.
Oh, I think that's why the Republican side of the game is so up in the air right now. There's just so many players.
Nobody has 50%.
Yep.
I mean, look, Trump's very popular. He speaks to people who are just angry. I think all of us experience that. You're angry, you're fed up with people telling you the same old PC answer. Mm-hmm. All right? And he's excelling at that. But he's a guy that's also, a couple years ago, said that Democrats provide the best economic model. Since when has tax and spend the great economic model?
Right.
Yeah.
I think one of his best characteristics and most effective characteristics is he plays the media like a fiddle. I mean, everything he does.
Have to spend a lot of money.
They play right into his hands.
For free.
He spent very little on his campaign, and the media covers him every day.
He is a master of the media. I mean, I don't think anybody can argue that he is playing a completely different game than everybody else. You have the rest of the people running a traditional or quasi-traditional campaign structure.
Right.
And he is running...
He's changing the rules.
A completely different game that changes the definition and the boundaries of where campaigns can go and can't go.
And nobody can keep up with it either. Nobody is second-guessing it. Nobody is nobody's correct on what's going to happen. It's like I was listening to somebody today, and they said that him backing out of this next debate, he may or may, you know, he's saying he's not going to go, but the smartest thing he could do now is show up, because he would have just got the last 7 days of media for free.
Interesting. And this program will air after that, so I guess the reason we don't know isn't because we neglected to watch. It's because
it just seems like everything
travel.
He does, the media goes sideways on it, and then it always works out for him. So
He's great at playing them, but he's been doing this for years. He's a media figure since the late 1970s.
Yep.
He has owned the media, the Trump brand, the reality TV show. Heck, I had the Trump board game in the 1980s.
You did?
Of course.
I didn't know there was a board game.
There's a board game, which is a lot like Monopoly, but not a complete ripoff. But how do you build up Atlantic casinos and a whole bunch of...
Exactly.
And a whole bunch of casinos,
That's funny.
Well, he's really is kind of redesigning the whole board of politics.
But going forward, could a regular candidate pull that off? See, I don't think they could. I mean, I don't know that he's necessarily blazed a trail anybody else could use.
I don't know that they get the slack that he does. I think the others would cannibalize him a little more.
Mm-hmm.
But still today, we can't say today who's going to be the nominee for sure. Yeah. There's pretty much a pathway, as far as I can see it, there's a pathway for three Republicans to be the nominee. You could either have Marco Rubio, you can have Ted Cruz, or you can have Donald Trump. Everybody else at this point is kind of running.
Unless something really major happens.
Crazy things happen.
Sure.
I'll totally give you the... But the three with the most likely pathway. Rubio and Cruz, they have a lot of cross between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Some people really like Cruz. Some people really like Marco. It's a conservative senator. It's a conservative first-term senator. That you can boil them down to both that.
Well, and everybody said forever that it would be Jeb Bush, just because the party would demand it. But in the system we just laid out, that's not actually possible.
Well, I think the party was demanding it, but they've got such.
You got to get everybody else to go along.
Well, but nobody else. Look, this is America. We hate dynasties.
Yes.
Okay. We're not going to put up with a third.
Right.
Okay. The voters aren't going to have it. And as much as anybody wants to say they can lead the voters by the nose, they're lying to you. Okay. The voters get to make up their mind. And no voter, and that's the same reason, I think anybody that's actually spent a lot of time thinking about it goes, say we did get into Bush versus Clinton. How do you think that's going to go for us with the rest of the non-political world?
Right.
Yeah. Not.
Yeah. No dynasty.
Terrible.
And it's sad, too, because the guy's totally qualified for the job, but because his last name is Bush, he's out.
And he was a pretty good governor.
Yeah,
especially in that time period. He said a lot of the right things, did a lot of the right things.
Bad timing.
Bad last name at this point.
Bad last name at that. Yeah, true story. All right, we're going to take one more break, and we'll be right back. Finish up top of the hour here. Talking about politics. We never do this much actual in-the-weeds politics. We always talk about issues. So we thought we'd take a little break and just talk about that kind of stuff. Hope you enjoyed it today. We'll be right back with you in a couple of minutes. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm your choice. I want to be a lady. I'm Yankee Doodle Dandy in a gold Rolls Royce. I want to be a lady. Kids want a savior and don't need a fake. I want to be a lady. We're all going to rock to the rules that I make. I want to be a lady. The Constitution, well, you know. We all want to change your head. You tell me it's the institution. Well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow.
Unless, of course, you're Bernie.
Or Hillary. She's already got the Chairman Mao outfit.
Hillary's wearing the Mao outfit, and yeah. Bernie wants to give it all away.
Yeah. The two of them.
Who would have thought?
They could take over China.
Who would have thought that would be popular? All right. So,
derail you here, but, you know,
we were talking about the
possibility of Biden getting into the race, but it's a timing thing.
It's a timing thing. It's tough at this point to get on the ballot unless he's sued in every 50 states.
But is it
57? What was the president? Oh, sorry.
It's funny. I was thinking it.
But that would be a brokered convention sort of a deal, wouldn't it?
Well, if he got on the ballot, you know, and people actually voted for him, then it wouldn't be a brokered convention because he would win the nomination through the same process as everybody else. If he didn't show up till after
the primary.
But if Hillary got the nomination and then got out,
then it would be a brokered convention.
Then he could step in and not worry about being on the ballot anywhere. He could just go in and the delegates could elect him.
You got it.
Yeah. So I think there's a game plan there. I think he just lays low and Uncle Joe just waits until Big O drops the axe on Hillary, which I'm not totally convinced he won't do. And do it after.
There was a lot of sucking up during the last debate.
Oh, there was.
Dear
He's holding
God,
all the cards.
The sucking sound was gigantic.
Yeah, he could just pardon her too.
Oh,
well,
yes,
he could pardon her, but I mean, as far as
he could preemptively pardon her before there was a charge.
Can you do that?
Sure, he could say, "I absolve you." You know, he's got presidential pardoning power. You don't even have to be charged. You could say, "Any past and wrongdoings of my administration are hereby deemed to be legal and good. Welcome to my kingdom."
Hear ye, hear ye. But if that happened after the primary and she was the nominee and then she got out, then Biden's in.
Biden could get in? Heck. So the rumors that you hear, right?
Elizabeth Warren, what about her?
You got Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
You got Michelle Obama.
Stop it.
Although the rumor is she's going to go back to Illinois and run for United States Senate.
Well, of course, Illinois. What better state for, you know, being a senator?
But
is there any way Obama runs for a third term under that scenario if Hillary's out?
Luckily for us, that's still unconstitutional.
Yeah, but
not that it stopped him before.
If the Justice Department doesn't press charges, he'll run for a third term.
He goes under Satoru.
Oh, yeah. He runs as
Barry Satoru.
There you go. From Indonesia.
From Hawaii.
Oh, from Hawaii. Sorry,
Hawaii.
I got it wrong.
That'll tell the Supreme Court, try and stop me.
Oh, my goodness. So it is, it's going to be very, very interesting these next few months. I mean, as sick as I think a lot of us are of all this campaigning.
Oh, I think it's going to be exciting.
I think once it gets closer to the primaries,
riveting.
It's going to be very exciting.
Well, and at the end of the day, too, don't forget. You know, people get all caught up in this presidential stuff, but what they don't realize is tons of things that affect them happen at the local level. Obviously, your city council, if you have one.
Usually those are in November.
Or your commissioners, board of supervisors, all that stuff that's really important, and those are campaigns to get involved in at your local level.
Yeah, your state assembly, state senate, U.S. Congress, all that stuff. That all happens. The primaries are all this spring, you know.
That's right. Right. And those, you can make a difference.
You make a huge difference. I mean, I always think about the one city council race here a few years ago, and we had moved into a different – we had moved into town.
Yeah.
We had moved into town. We could never vote in the city before. We moved into town 2 weeks before the election, actually took our ballots down to the clerk's office, had them changed for the new address, voted, and that guy won by 11 votes. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Well, don't think the grassroots – I mean, look, Ted Cruz
we counted.
United States Senator today because of grassroots. He was not the guy that anybody thought was actually going to win from Texas. He was not
really
the handpicked guy. The lieutenant governor of the state was running.
That was David Dewhurst was running against Cruz. Yeah, the sitting lieutenant governor.
Look at you. You are Wikipedia.
Well, he is.
Thank God. At least we have somebody here who knows this stuff. I did not know that.
I do stuff for Texas on the side. I'm a little
Oh, that's
Texas
right. You do their
politics
news and stuff. We have a cheater's
yeah,
in
better
here.
Better be up on their politics.
Yeah, really.
But you're right. No one expected Cruz to win that.
Not against the lieutenant governor. And in Texas, the lieutenant governor is a very strong lieutenant governor. They do a lot more stuff than, like, in California, where the lieutenant governor's basic job is to check if Jerry
the
Brown
governor's
has
still
a pulse.
Alive.
Does he have a pulse? Yeah, I'm going to go to one of the 57 boards and commissions that I'm put on this year.
Yeah, what does the lieutenant governor do? Just hangs around and waits
on,
to...
Actually, I think it's 113 boards and commissions. Sits on the UC Board of Regents.
Do you remember when Mike Curb was lieutenant governor, a Republican, when Jerry Brown was governor the first time around? He had Brown afraid to leave the state because Curb would go in and enact all this legislation when he was the...
Oh, really?
Acting governor.
Oh, he'd veto and sign. And,
oh, really? Oh, so he couldn't...
It's pretty funny. Turn your back on your own lieutenant governor.
That's pretty funny, actually.
That's the joy of an independent election.
Darn, that would have been fun to do.
That's funny.
Okay, so now if Bloomberg decides he wants to jump in on this presidential thing, when's his cutoff?
He's got a much later cutoff. He can wait it out and see what happens with Hillary.
Yeah.
But think about this. You could have Hillary Clinton, New York, Donald Trump, New York, Michael Bloomberg, New York.
Right.
Right.
All of them with over $1 billion. Now, Bloomberg makes Trump look like a piker. Okay?
Oh, no kidding.
Really?
He's got a net worth exceeding $47 billion. He said he's willing to spend over $1 billion of his own dollars because
well,
he's
got Well,
he
has 47
it.
Of them. Man.
You know,
Trump's, I didn't realize
this
that.
Is what they mean by New York values.
New York values, yeah. But at the same point in time, you know, Hillary's going to have and raise, although we talked about burn rate earlier. So in her last financial report coming up, mid-November? So she'd raised $145 million and spent it all.
Mm-hmm.
She had $700,000 cash on hand last November, which, you know, talk about burn rate.
Yeah, no kidding. Ouch. Of course, with those other two guys, that's chump change. They got that in the cushions of their jet.
Yeah, no fooling. I had no idea. I didn't know he was worth that much.
I knew Bloomberg was wealthy, but I didn't think he was more
wealthy. But think about,
you
know, this
Trump.
Is anti-gun, anti-soda Bloomberg.
Oh, yeah, that would be...
You know, basically the
soda
guy
ban. Oh, my God. Can you imagine that at the federal level?
Keep your hands off my Pepsi.
Exactly.
Pry it out of my cold, dead fingers.
And they would be cold for multiple reasons.
That's right. And sweaty. Oh, I think there's some twists and turns coming. I really do. And I think it all kind of pivots on Hillary, what's going to happen there.
Yeah. But, I mean, look, at the same point in time, Bloomberg gets in, you pretty much assure a Republican go. Because no Republican is going to vote for Bloomberg. Bloomberg was elected as a Republican, switched to independent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then went all socialist.
And then turned left.
Yeah, and then, drank the Kool-Aid.
Big time. Wow. Huh. Well, it's going to be kind of fun.
It's going to be a bloody mess coming
up. Yes, it is.
I think it's going to be, Totally.
Enjoy it. Remember to vote.
Exactly.
Any bets on whether Trump's going to show up at the debate?
Since this will air afterward and we're either going to look really smart or really stupid.
I don't think he shows up.
Yeah, I don't think he shows up.
I don't think he does either.
All right, it's 3-0. So bottom line is make sure you're registered to vote. That would be imperative.
And show up because it does count.
And make sure you're registered to vote where you live now in case you moved or something. So get cracking on that. And if you like somebody who's running or you want to learn about it, volunteer for their campaign. You'll learn all about them. It's a great way to learn about the candidates.
Vote early and often.
That too.
That often thing will send you to jail.
Only if they catch you. Oh, my gosh. So we'll be back next week with something else. I forget what we're doing, but it'll be fun. You'll like it.
Yeah.
So join us online and send this show to a friend, especially if they don't know what's going on. This will smarten them up or make them feel totally dopey like the rest of us. WeThePeopleRadio.us. See you next week.